like to introduce Professor Franz Vonderdunk. Professor Franz Vonderdunk is the Harvey and Susan Perlman Alumni Otmar Professor of Space Law at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's Program on Space and Communications. Previously, he was the Director of Space Law Research at the International Institute of Air and Space Law at Leiden University. Professor Vonderdunk was awarded the Distinguished Service Award of the International Institute of Space Law of the International Astronautical Federation in October 2004. He defended his dissertation on private enterprise and public interest in the European spacescape in 1998. He has over 120 publications and has given some 120 presentations at international meetings and was a visiting professor at some 25 universities on subjects of space law and policy. Much of his recent work focused on such topical issues as space tourism, the legal status of the moon and other celestial bodies, and the sale of lunar estate hoax and planetary protection. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Professor Franz Vonderdunk.
Thank you very much. Thank you also to George Niels for inviting me to talk to you about some of the legal issues. And I think, actually, that is very brave, George, to invite me here as a keynote speaker. First of all, because I am a law professor, and everybody in the business is used to talk about the wizards and the angel investors who all make this happen. And of course, it takes a lawyer to bring in the witches. So I apologize for that on beforehand. And even worse, I'm a Dutch lawyer, and as you heard from Congressman Palazzo, we are basically experts in one-way tickets to outer space. We're not really interested in getting people back safely. So the three witches of private commercial spaceflight, and I'm going to focus. There's a lot of issues to talk about, and I had to pick just a few in order to not talk for 3 hours. So I decided to just pick three issues related to private commercial spaceflight, in particular the suborbital issues, although we will touch upon some of the orbital issues as well, because I think there is a nexus there. Now, this is, of course, the bad news that nobody wants to see, but that a lawyer is always ready to deal with. And the three issues that I'm going to deal with all have to do with jurisdiction and liability in this context of private commercial spaceflight. So we have third-party liability, and I'm going to spend a few words on the national and the international aspects. I'm basing myself on the assumption that not all of you are familiar with the legal aspects of private commercial spaceflight to that extent. Then I'm going to address passenger liability, or the word passenger is, of course, colloquial for spaceflight participant in this particular context, but I'm going to continue to use the word passenger, if only because it fits more closely into the slide. And then the last one is the on-orbit operations, which is an issue which has also repeatedly come up already in discussions and which I think is going to be ever more important. So what is the problem here? Well, on the one hand, you cannot kill or allow to be killed innocent third parties, but at the same time, you do not want to kill the business either. And that's, of course, one of the issues that the FAA is facing all the time. Now, this particular issue of third-party liability is dealing both with manned and unmanned launches, so the picture is broader, certainly at first instance, than just the satellite launches, the commercial launches. It also talks about private commercial spaceflight with humans on board. Internationally, we have most famously a liability convention of 1972, to which, by the way, the United States is a party, as are all the other main spacefaring nations, Russia, China, France, other European countries, Brazil, India, you name it. And the main elements are sort of summarized in these three lines. So the launching state of a space object causing the damage is liable. And the launching state is defined in four different ways in the liability convention. Most importantly, it includes the state from whose territory is launched. And it is liable to another state or states. So this is really a state liability system whereby the claimant state or states can claim, including on behalf of their nationals, if they sustain damage. There is strict liability for damage on Earth. There are just a very limited set of exceptions to absolute liability. And there is no limit in principle to compensation. So if $20 billion of damage are caused, then $20 billion of damage have to be compensated in principle. Now, one major consequence of the state liability system is that it doesn't formally require, but at least in practice, requires a launching state or the launching states to license, because they will be held responsible, or I should actually say liable, on the international level if something goes wrong. The bill first goes to the State Department and not to the private operator. That's very important to realize. Nationally, in the US case, that has led, of course, back in 1984, to the US Commercial Space Launch Act, which is the main act dealing with third-party liability also in the US context. And the main elements are, of course, that through a licensing system, in particular for the launch operator, but also for the launch site operator, but I'm going to focus on the launch operator, this licensing system allows the United States to make sure that it can control whatever goes into outer space so that it knows what it may be held liable for under the liability convention. Now, the license obligation applies both to a U.S. launch operator, regardless from where he is launching, which is important also for private commercial spaceflight. If operators want to go launch from Curacao or Sweden or any other place in the world, if they are U.S. operators, they still require a U.S. license. And vice versa, if foreign operators come to the U.S. and want to launch from here, they require a license as well. Now, how is the system further elaborated in the US? There is a quite elaborate, I should say, third-party liability regime in the context of the US Commercial Space Launch Act, which has always been named or labeled a three-tier system, which, however, is essentially focusing on domestic application. And this is one point of note to which I will come back. What does it say? Well, there's a first tier which has to be compensated by the licensee. So suppose something goes wrong, damage claims come in, the licensee has to compensate up to a first tier, and for that first tier he has to be taking out insurance covering him to that extent, unless he can prove that he can pay it from his own financial resources. Now, the first tier, the cap, the limit of that first tier is calculated in a somewhat complicated fashion. It's the lowest of one of these three. Whichever is the lowest, that's where we end up to in the license. So it's either the maximum probable loss, which is a sort of calculation based on a 1 in 10 million chance of an accident of that size happening, insurance coverage available at reasonable rates on the world market, or if both are still, or either of them are still above $500 million, then $500 million is the maximum. Now, to give you a little bit of an idea, the actual amounts that are quoted so far in the non-manned space flight business have been $261 million, so a little over half of that maximum. And in the case of Spaceship One, which is, of course, so far the only manned space flight ever taking place under this regime, it was $3.1 million only, because it was a small spaceship and it was just flying for a short period in outer space, etc., and over the desert at that. Then there is a second tier, which is possibly going to be indemnified by the U.S. government. Formally speaking, there is no obligation. There is just a promise to ask Congress for the special appropriation. So rather than in other countries outside of the United States, where there is a much more simple system, this still requires some political wheeling and dealing before you actually get a bill like that in Congress. Now, the second tier can run up to $1.5 billion in 1988 rates. I checked a few days ago, and that's almost double that now in today's rates. So that second tier above the first tier is expected to be compensated by Congress. If not, everybody is in big trouble. And then there's a third tier if the damage goes even above the combination of the total of the first and the second, then it's probably again for the licensee to compensate if he still has some money left in his resources. But then again, we're talking about a very unlikely event in any place. Now, this is, as I said, the application domestically. And this is the way the Act reads. Now, there's also the international aspects where actually it works the other way around. because here it's not the private operator which is going to be held liable under U.S. law and a U.S. court. Here it's the United States as a state which is going to be held liable in the international arena. And there the first tier, as a consequence, means that the United States wants to get back some of its money from the licensee. So the limitation of the first tier in that sense works the other way around. That is where the U.S. Is covered by insurance as well. And then the second tier, there is no choice for Congress to take upon itself that second tier or not. That is an international obligation, and unless or until the United States steps out of the liability convention, the United States government has to pay that second tier, regardless of its internal financial statutes and regulations. And there is not really a third tier, in essentially, because for the third tier, the same applies. Remember, the compensation on the international level under the liability convention is unlimited. Now, the phrasing, as I said, of the Commercial Space Launch Act makes clear that in the U.S. case, the focus is on domestic third party, on what happens if something goes wrong within the United States. And that makes a lot of sense, of course. I mean, the first phase of the launch is by far the most risky one. If you look at the requirement of the insurance coverage in the regulations, you'll find that up to 30 days after payload separation or the launch itself, you need to be insured, and apparently after that 30-day period, you're basically considered safe, at least for practical purposes. And in addition, of course, launch sites are close to open waters in the United States, or at least very far from international borders. So if something happens, it will be primarily taking place in the United States. But that is not always the same elsewhere in the world. If you look at the other third-party liabilities, for obvious reasons, they focus on international third-party liability. For example, in the case of France, you have a much more simple system whereby there is simply a maximum limit to liability of, in current currency, about $81 million for international third-party liability damage resulting from Arianespace launches at Kourou. And even though Kourou launches into over the open seas as well, the concerns are basically with international liability, even if private liability is then, or I should say domestic liability is then regulated in the same vein. It's sort of regulated in passing. State coverage about the cap is unlimited and without condition. There's no need to first bring a bill to the French Senate in order to get that second cap paid, and that again has to do with the fact that France is primarily eyeing its international obligations, where there is no way of getting out of that obligation. You cannot refuse to pay that. And I think that in all the discussions on the third-party liability regime and the indemnification discussion in Congress here, that's something that should be taken into consideration as well. Okay, so now we move to manned spaceflight, which we want all to be very safe, of course. So this is where the second witch comes in. Of course, you don't want to have people on board killed either. At the same time, you don't want to overregulate. We hear it time and again. And of course, that's a very appropriate point. Now, this is in particular about the manned launches, where only on manned launches you have passengers. That's by definition the case. So what do we have there? Well, 20 years after its original enunciation, the Commercial Space Launch Act was amended, as most of you, I guess, know by now, and that has been codified in 51, in Part 51 of the U.S. State Code, in order to take care of that possible issue. Now, there were inter-party liability clauses in the original 1984 Act. They dealt with the use of government facilities where there was a certain indemnification, and then a cross waiver. There was a contractual liability waiver imposed by the regime, but when it came to passengers, they were clearly they were officially not included in that cross waiver. And that's not a self-evident issue, because one of the House proposals, one of the House drafts, still had it in there that those contractual waivers were also to apply to passengers. So as far as that part of the Act is concerned, there is no contractual waiver of liability vis-à-vis the passengers. Now, the FAA has not been given any authority to impose safety-related certification, and as most of you know, that is extended so far until October 2015. which means that informed consent, this famous or infamous informed consent regime, is the basic element of how to deal with passengers in the context of the unlikely event of an accident. What is informed consent? You have to sign that you know that you're flying on an uncertified spacecraft or an uncertified vehicle. The word spacecraft is not in there. Which probably leads to a presumption of absence of contractual liability, but ultimately, of course, that is up to the court to decide. And that's, of course, where then something else comes in, namely six states so far, Virginia, Florida, New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, and California, not accidentally six of the leading states in terms of private commercial spaceflight, have developed statutes which go one step further and explicitly link this informed consent to a waiver of operator liability. Under each of those six acts, and they differ, but each of them requires you to sign an informed consent clause, which is actually dictated by the statute. And once you do that, you cannot claim liability against the operator if something then happens. You go on your own risk. Now, what does that mean? In the US perspective, this is essentially about the classical federal versus state jurisdiction issue. So it's a battle between, do we talk about this on the federal level or do we talk about this on the individual state level? Now, a set of problems arise if you see the problem from that perspective. First of all, the phrasing of informed consent as it is provided by the statutes differs. I'm not going to go into details, and in some cases the differences are minor, but they can still lead to problems. As you no doubt know, lawyers can, if one comma is put in the wrong place, they can already make a case out of it, so I'm sure there will be lawyers who might be willing to jump on this one as well. More important is that the immunity does not apply to the space operator only, but also to various sets of assorted related entities or persons. And in this respect, the acts vary. Some are more generous than others. In one act, only those who are responsible for the payloads fall within the immunity, just like the spaceflight operator. In other cases, even a whole range of individuals involved may benefit from that, or benefit is probably not the right word. It is the right word, actually. May benefit from that waiver of immunity as well. Then the exceptions to the immunity vary. Some of the acts just have two exceptions, and one is a combination of gross negligence, willful, and wanton disregard, and I sort of skip over the minute differences in phrasing between those various terms, but basically that focuses on the same thing. And the second exception is that intentional injury. Well, those are pretty clear and pretty confined, and you can pretty much imagine what they mean. But some other state statutes have a third one. If you know of the existence of a dangerous condition, that already can take you out of the immunity as an operator. And this, of course, leads to problems because the whole thing of private commercial spaceflight at the current point is that you know that you're doing something dangerous, and that's precisely why you want to do it. I mean, this is about an excitement, right? So does this mean that it preempts the whole statute? What is the issue here? And then finally, I had a student in Nebraska who did some research on this and is going to continue on this. She's actually going to write a dissertation on this. In the six states, there is also a common law liability regime, which still may play into this in cases where the statute, which are not covered by the statutes, in some cases, actually, she concluded that the common law liability waivers were broader than the statute, so rather than benefiting the operator, they provided for additional issues. So what are the problems then from a federal perspective? Well, first of all, how informed can consent be? I'm not going to dwell too much on that, but that's also an issue as well. Can heirs be bound by the consent of the spaceflight participant? Or is how can you bind an heir to something that that the spaceflight participant, maybe without him or her knowing that, took on? And in particular, the different phrasing of the acts there may result in problems. Some refer to the heirs, others to the estates, and most importantly, we talk about also the limited territorial scope, because what those statutes say is that within Virginia, Florida, Texas, you name it, you cannot sue for liability. But what if a smart heir goes outside to one of the other 44 states? or perhaps even abroad. Those people are not only going to fly U.S. passengers. They're going to fly everyone who's willing to pay, right? So if it's a Dutch citizen or a French citizen and he's going to sue in France or the Netherlands, does it work? And then, of course, we have still 44 U.S. states so far left without any statute, which means that the common law applies. But again, there we have a lot of uncertainties. And then finally, I'm not going to dwell on that because it's been touched upon before as well. There is, of course, a NASA interest and interest of other government entities in flying on these suborbital flights as well, which also would not be very work very elegantly if the result is that you have to go through these various state statutes in order to find out what the exact legal situation is. So in other words, I think there would be a good case for federal preemption here. The FAA has a regulatory authority at the federal level, and even if it's limited so far by Congress to light regulation, there is this authority, which is a primary argument for allowing federal legislation to preempt. The particular section of the Act basically says that as long as state statutes are not inconsistent, they can apply, and they may be additional or more stringent, but that is of course a dubious term because it depends on from what end do you think it's more stringent. Is it going to be more stringent for the passengers or more stringent for the operators? So there is some uncertainty already there. Now I think this conference proves this, there is any question that private spaceflight in the United States is of national interest. It's overstepped the boundaries of individual states to vie for these operators. That's both on an economic perspective, and here I refer to the Commerce Clause, which makes that clear. It's not something which is by definition limited only to Colorado. And it's also from a security perspective, because obviously we're talking about space technology, we're talking about ITARs, we're talking about the issue of informed consent, which may play into security issues as well. So I don't think there's a question there. And furthermore, there are these international ramifications. What if US operators start launching from or operating from Sweden, Curaçao, the United Arab Emirates, South Korea, or any other place in the world? So this is viewed from the international perspective as forum shopping, license shopping, what is happening in the US. There is no international regulation whatsoever, but these six states, they act like they're in a beauty contest and they want to present themselves as the most beautiful state to start launching from. And of course, what doesn't help this is that there is no international regulation whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, once you start thinking about bringing this to the international level, and that's important for US operators going outside as well, in many non-US jurisdictions, you cannot write your life away. You cannot write an informed consent clause and something like that. It may even be unconstitutional. And since US operators going abroad, even though they might need a US license, obviously also need a local license, this may result in considerable additional obstacles for them in the licensing context. On third-party liability, there's no international regulation as regards passengers as well, or the way to deal with these issues. Territories of convenience would suffer most heavily and firstly when something goes wrong. So there is no regulation which tries to limit or sort of bound the level of license requirements. And you may, in principle, have a flag of convenience, although again, this is probably not very likely to happen for the time being. And then in addition, there's the beauty of the state liability system, that a state which would perhaps be tempted to allow a cheap licensing, a cheap flag to be used for its launches, will still be held liable as a state on the international level for the private operations. So they might be tempted to think twice in that regard. Still, US operators also outside the US are subject to the Commercial Space Launch Act, as I said, and non-US operators may still try to escape the application of the Commercial Space Launch Act. So there is this question mark. I'm not going to answer that, but it may be an issue for discussion. If not here, then in other fora, there might be a need for international harmonization, or at least discussions on the key elements where nations across the world should apply the same level of regulation. Now, this is all about what essentially could be could be labeled sophisticated kind of bungee jumping, right? It's about the experience. But what happens if we move to true suborbital transportation from A to B? Now, we are not ready for that. So what are you going to do with anything else happening on board? What are you going to do with the jurisdiction on those ships? And this is of course, what brings me to the issue of on-orbit jurisdiction. We have regulations for these types of flights. It's simply U.S. airspace. It's a U.S. aircraft flying in U.S. From one U.S. city to another. No problem. The U.S. regulates what happens on board. If you light a cigarette on board, you're liable to a prosecution under U.S. law. Now, it becomes a little bit more complicated if you fly across the ocean, because obviously the ocean is no man's land, and you may depart from the United States, but you may land in the Netherlands. But even there, we have an international system under ICAO sort of setting the basic borderlines as to where which state can apply its legislation to control what's happening on board. More precisely, it is the law of registration of the state of the aircraft. What happens now if we move even higher and further away, up into outer space? Well, the status quo, and this applies again back to an original situation, also to unmanned space activities, not just to manned space flight. Internationally, we have the Registration Convention, another one of these international conventions drafted in the UN context. With both the United States and all other important spacefaring nations being parties. One issue there is that you need to qualify your vehicle as a space object in order to get it registered, which has some issues of definition. Is a suborbital vehicle, is that indeed a space object? My impression is yes, but there are people who try to argue the opposite. Well, the Registration Convention, through the registration of the space object, allows the exercise of quasi-territorial jurisdiction on board, even in outer space. So a U.S.-registered spacecraft or the U.S.-registered part of the International Space Station is basically a kind of U.S. territory floating in outer space for legal purposes. So no problem is what you would think. But unfortunately, here in the United States, things have been made more complicated. Because what you see here is that the FCC has the license in terms of unmanned space operations to license telecom satellite operations, which are in outer space, of course, and it does so through applying to U.S. operators, but it can also use the registration of those satellites as U.S. objects. Something similar happens in the remote sensing satellite business, where the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration can exercise this licensing authority. And the FAA, and that's, of course, our host of today, can license or permit, to use another word for the experimental permits, the launch and the reentry of objects launched into outer space. But what happens in between? And this is the so-called issue of on-orbit jurisdiction. Now, as a lawyer, if you have a problem with something, you try to look at the definitions, because that's maybe where the problem can be found originally. So what is on-orbit jurisdiction? Which is then especially relevant for manned space activities, because there you have all these unpredictable humans on board who may start to get into a fight or who may fall in love or whatever they might do, which you hadn't expected up front, and you still want to have some legal tools to regulate. So what does the law say? Well, the US law says, first of all, indeed, the license is required for the launch and the reentry, so nothing about what happens in between the two. The definition of launch is sort of complicated, but I here try to highlight the key elements. So it is to place a launch vehicle, reentry vehicle, and anything else in a suborbital trajectory in Earth orbit in outer space or otherwise in outer space. So as long as you bring something to outer space, you have the authority to regulate that, which, strictly speaking, may extend into outer space as long as that still is part of the launch or the reentry. And by the way, a reentry, by definition, starts in outer space, because the whole idea of reentry is that you come back from outer space into the atmosphere. This is maybe a sort of a legal way of reasoning. So the FAA has jurisdiction on all the activities related to the launch or the reentry, even if they may take place in outer space. If somebody in outer space prepares for reentry, in a private commercial vehicle, that is basically still falling under FAA jurisdiction. Now, an additional add-on is if you look at the Code of Federal Regulation, that the extent of the insurance obligation, as I mentioned before, extends even further. It extends into 30 days after payload separation or the launch, properly speaking. So there is sort of a fudgy area in between the launch and the re-entry where some jurisdiction may apply, although it clearly doesn't regulate human behavior. Now, another problem comes in, and this is about the terms orbital versus suborbital. If you would sort of in 2 minutes try to explain what orbital and suborbital is, I think you would all think that there's a clear difference between the two. No problem. So what is orbital? Orbital is, of course, an operational criterion, which means that you complete at least one full orbit around the Earth, preferably a lot more, which is almost by definition meaning that you fly in outer space, because that's where orbits can be sustained. If as soon as you go too low in the airspace, the atmosphere starts dragging you down, and not to mention gravity. And in outer space, there's no territorial jurisdiction, but of course, we luckily have the registration convention to help us out on that and allow for exercise of jurisdiction on board. Entry into orbit, and of course, the re-entry from orbit, however, requires traversing airspace. And we saw some of the earlier speakers mentioning the definition of national airspace, which goes into this discussion. How are you going to make sure that these launch and re-entry operations fit into this broader scheme? Now, from this perspective, suborbital is by definition not completing at least one full orbit, which is also an operational criterion. However, that does not mean that part of a trajectory cannot be in outer space. And that is some of the mistakes that are usually made in the definitional area, that people think suborbital by definition doesn't mean outer space. No, no, no. It just means that it doesn't complete an orbit around the Earth. And some of course, the misunderstanding is logical, because the word sub means or suggests that you remain below a certain altitude, but suborbital launches can go much higher than Earth orbits. There are suborbital launches which go up to 1,500 kilometers. So a part of an orbital trajectory may even be followed, and this is where the problems arise. Now, usually people show pictures of Virgin Galactic. I choose to take the picture of some of another operator, likely impending operator, XCOR, partly because it is so clear from the trajectory. If you now think about the FAA having launch and re-entry jurisdiction, the moment the launch ends, which would be about here, it sort of seamlessly goes into a re-entry phase. So there's no lack of jurisdiction. So currently, there might not be much of a problem. However, that is, of course, not where the development will stop. And now, as a lawyer, I go on thin ice, because I have no idea what this particular slide was referring to. But I could imagine that it could refer to future manned spaceflight. Because look at the figures. You see here altitude of about 800 kilometers to cover something like a 4,000 kilometer horizontal trajectory. If you fly from one coast to the other in the United States, you clearly get above any orbit. You clearly go into outer space for a major part of the trajectory. What happens in there? Is this still part of the launch? Is this already part of the re-entry? What are you going to do there? Sorry. Next one. This is another slide which tends to presume that if you want to fly from New York to Sydney, again, you have the altitude in feet here in the millions. This is 1 million feet. Understanding is that you, whatever it means in detail, that you can fly certain considerable parts in outer space which cannot be called launch. And in particular, if you have these sort of going back up again and going down again, where's the launch and where's the re-entry? And of course, more importantly, we are talking about other countries being involved as well, because it's not just the US which can have a say on this. It's obviously also the Australians which have a say, in particular, on the re-entry. Next slide. Okay, so this was advertised on the web as an orbit, but I don't know why after some period in time, this couldn't go down again. So what I'm trying to say here is that the differentiation between suborbital and orbits may disappear in the future, and that's where we may have a problem, and that's where we also may need to think about how to logically structure jurisdiction. So future truly orbital operations in preparation or at least seriously plans. We heard about the service flights to the ISS. They're about to happen within 1 or 2 years. SpaceX, Boeing, and Sierra Nevada are probably ready to go. A little later, we have Bigelow with their space hotels, which may orbit for hundreds of orbits or thousands of orbits for many years in outer space. And we need this type of orbital or space jurisdiction. Space hotel operations themselves. And then I think there's not really a problem in that sense. I mean, you can use the International Registration Convention, you can use the U.S. registration to exercise U.S. jurisdiction on board. It's just an internal matter. But I don't see any reason why there could not be in-space jurisdiction on board space object launch under FAA license in order to cover the broad range of what has often been called the non-preordained human activities now possible. People getting into a fight or people falling in love, whatever you want to see. So I think that at the end of the day, they may be witches, but they don't look that bad, do they? Thank you very much.